We have studied quantum field theory in the Heisenberg picture, where it is the fields that evolve in time. But as with every quantum theory, there is also a Schrödinger picture for quantum field theory. So even though we are describing the second quantization of the Klein-Gordon equation, there is a Schrödinger equation for it, which is of the usual form, IH bar d by dt, acting on the state, which is now time-dependent, equal to Hamiltonian times state, time-dependent state. Even though the whole thing describes the Klein-Gordon equation, which is second order in time. So today we move from the Heisenberg to the Schrödinger picture. We will not actually, in the rest of the course, use the Schrödinger picture. I may mention it once or twice, but in cosmology, we usually work in the Heisenberg picture, where the state is frozen and the operators, the observables, move in time. But for completeness, we should do it. Also, you may want to use the Schrödinger picture for the project. It could be convenient. But judge yourself whether you want to use the Schrödinger or the Heisenberg picture for that purpose. Now, the Schrödinger picture for quantum field theory is a little abstract. So just be prepared for this. It's not actually complicated, it's just a little abstract. Okay, so remember what we did so far? We looked at waves, and we said that just like in a pond, you can think of the surface of the water as consisting of harmonic oscillators that are coupled. And just like you can probe the oscillations of water in a pond by putting a cork in it, which will then bob up and down. Similarly, for quantum fields, we can visualize that at every point in space, there is a harmonic oscillator, and these harmonic oscillators are coupled. And we found that if we Fourier transform the field, then we obtain one harmonic oscillator per point in momentum space, and these are not coupled. Later, we will generalize that to quantum field theory, where it's not as easy as just Fourier transforming to decouple those harmonic oscillators, but there will be something similar to that. And there will also be something similar to a cork. A cork put into a lake to probe the oscillations at a point. Similarly, in quantum field theory, we can put the equivalent of a pork, of a cork, somewhere to probe the oscillations of the quantum field. And that could be an atom or a molecule, which will get excited when exposed to the local field. We will get to that in lecture 8. Today is lecture 4. Now, assume we have some means to measure the amplitude phi hat of x and t. We will study how actually to do that using atoms or molecules in lecture 8. But for now, let's just assume we have some means for measuring these observables. Right? These things are self-adjoint operators. At every point in position, there's a self-adjoint operator. And as a self-adjoint operator, it is qualifying to be called an observable, independently of whether we can actually dream up a machine that will measure it. So let's assume, though, we can actually measure that. Just before a moment that you can think of arrangements with atoms and molecules and so on to actually get effectively a measurement of a field. Now imagine that we have set up an arrangement so that we can measure the field amplitude at one point in time everywhere. So imagine that we make a snapshot measurement where at every point in space, we measure what the amplitude of the field is. It's a self-adjoint operator. The outcome of the measurement will be a real number. So the measurement outcome will be a real number at every point. Why can we measure these things jointly? In quantum theory, we always have to ask, can we measure observables simultaneously? And here we have infinitely, in fact, uncountably many observables in principle that we could measure the phi hat at all x. But since they are commuting at equal time, in principle, there's nothing in the way of nothing obstructing a measurement of all of them simultaneously. In fact, we can think of all of those self-adjoint operators, the phi that belong to all of those positions, we can consider all of these operators phi hat of x for all x as being a maximal set of commuting observables. Just like when you have the quantum mechanics of one particle, the three position operators form a maximal set of commuting observables. The three momentum operators form a maximal set of commuting observables. The Hamiltonian and the angular momentum L vector squared and L3 form a maximal set of commuting observables for suitable Hamiltonians if they're rotational symmetric, and so on. And we know that if we measure these observables simultaneously of a maximal set of commuting observables, then we've pinned down the state exactly. The joint eigenbasis of a maximal set of commuting observables forms an eigenbasis of the entire Hilbert space, and that's often used to write down wave functions, position wave functions, momentum wave functions, or for the hydrogen atom, for example, wave functions in terms of n, the main quantum number, L and n. Here, the phi hat of x are infinitely many observables that together form a maximal set of commuting observables, even in principle, also really there are big functional analytic subtleties with this. Okay, so let's assume we perform that measurement. It is as if we took a snapshot of the lake, but in this case it's a quantum field, and we measure the observable. The outcome of the measurement will be a real number, because phi hat of x is a self-adjoint operator for each x. So we get a measurement outcome. Let us call that measurement outcome phi of x, but now without a hat. It's like measuring the position operator in quantum mechanics. Position operator is x hat, but the measurement outcome we will call x, just a number. So we've performed the measurement on the quantum field, and we get a measurement outcome phi hat of x. So for every location x, we find a real number. Then, after we've done that, the state of the quantum field will have changed. No matter what it was before, now, after the measurement, immediately after the measurement, it's in an eigenstate of all those operators that we measure. Just like when you measure the momentum of a particle in ordinary quantum mechanics, after the momentum measurement, assuming it was a perfect measurement, the particle is in a momentum eigenstate. This simply reflects the fact that now we know the momentum. Knowing the momentum means it has to be in a momentum eigenstate. So similarly here, we've measured the field amplitude, so we know the field amplitude, and the state for which we know the field amplitude is a field eigenstate, field operator eigenstate. Let us give that state a name. Let's call it vector phi. So this is a vector in the Hilbert space of the quantum field theory, and it is joint eigenvector of all those phi hat operators, phi hat of x, with the eigenvalues for the various x's, with the eigenvalues given by that function. So depending on what state the field started out in, the quantum field started out in, and dependent on the outcome of all those measurements, after all there is some quantum uncertainty in this, we get some function phi of x, and generally if you perform the same experiment multiple times, you get different functions phi of x just because of the quantum uncertainties. But if you perform a measurement, you get these measurement outcomes phi of x, real valued function of space, and that determines uniquely then the state phi in the Hilbert space. And this is a joint eigenvector of all these operators where we run through all possible x's. Meaning that if you apply the field operator, phi hat at x, onto that state, then you get the eigenvalue that we measured. And that's true for all x's. All of this is analogous, completely analogous to what we have in first quantization, where we would have, let's say, lots of position operators, let's call them q hat a, and the a runs from 1 to 3 if you have one particle, but if you have 100 particles, a runs from 1 to 300. So we have these position operators, and we write as q, this is an abbreviated notation. I could really write here q1, q2, q3, etc. for all a. This is a vector which is jointly eigenvector of all of the position operators. And if you apply one particular position operator on it, you get qa, you get the eigenvalue with regard to that one. It's just as usual. This would be the position eigenbasis for multiple positions. And here we have multiple operators phi hat of x and a basis vector and an eigenvector of all of them jointly. Okay, are there any questions about this so far? That's super foundational. Yes.
Sorry, in the quantum mechanical case, the eigenvectors of time-dependent operators are also time-dependent, right?
If the operators depend on time,
yes,
then at every time the eigenvector could be a different vector in principle. That's right. And here too, in principle, yes. Mm-hmm. Because still we are working in the Heisenberg picture. Later we will work in the Schrödinger picture. And then that's no longer the case, but you're right. In principle, because the phi hat of x depend on time, the eigenvectors will also depend on time. I didn't write it because I was thinking of taking a snapshot, right? So at one point in time, we're looking at all those operators phi hat of x and t. So t is fixed, but we run through all x's, and then we measure, and then we find these eigenvectors. So in principle, if the field theory is a complicated one, it could be that a little moment later, the phi hat x operator is very different from what it was before, and then this vector is no longer an eigenvector to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is right after the measurement, immediately after the measurement. Here's an example. Let us assume that the system is in the vacuum state. If you remember, that means that the system is in the joint ground state of all the harmonic oscillators that we obtain in momentum space. Remember that if we write down the Klein-Gordon equation in position space, we see that at every position we have a harmonic oscillator, but because of the presence of the Laplace operator in the Klein-Gordon equation, these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. That's the reason why waves spread. The harmonic oscillators at one point will excite the harmonic oscillators around them, and so on. But then we did a Fourier transform. Then the Laplacian became k squared, which is just a number. So we obtained that in momentum space, the Klein-Gordon equation is simply a harmonic oscillator for each k. For each momentum, it's an independent harmonic oscillator. There's no derivative that couples them. In momentum space, the excitations of the harmonic oscillators don't spread. If you excite one of those harmonic oscillators, so you have a field which has a certain wavelength, then that will be it forever, in principle, because you've just generated a wave of wavelength, let's say 5 meters, and it will just oscillate and stay a wavelength of 5 meters. It will not suddenly become a wavelength of 3 meters or something like that. So in momentum space, the excitation doesn't spread to the other momentum. Except, of course, in curved spacetime, there it will. There, if you create a wave of wavelength 5 meters and you wait a little, because of the expansion of the universe, the wavelength will increase. So we will have to do something like an adaptive Fourier transform in order to obtain a description of the Klein-Gordon equation in which, again, the harmonic oscillators are uncoupled. Because in principle, the expansion of the space-time couples now. Anyway, so this is still Minkowski space. We Fourier transformed into momentum space. in momentum space, we have at every point in momentum space a harmonic oscillator, and we're looking at the ground state of that. This is the lowest energy state for each of the harmonic oscillators. For all of them together, it's also the lowest energy state. It's still infinite energy because each harmonic oscillator contributes 1/2 h bar omega. And they add up to an infinity, and we'll have to address that later on. But it's still the minimum energy state for each one of the harmonic oscillators. And for now, we will call that the vacuum state, the ground state of the quantum field. Later we will see that the two notions, minimum energy state and no particle state, are actually different. But in Minkowski space, they are still the same. So let's assume we take for each harmonic oscillator its ground state. And then we have a state for the quantum field theory. So we have all these operators, all these observables, phi hat of x and t, but we hold t fixed. We have all these operators, phi hat of x, and we have a state. And now we can go and measure the value for phi hat. We measure that observable. It has a certain spread that we can calculate, certain probability distribution, as we discussed. And if you actually go out there in nature and you measure this amplitude, you will find a function phi of x. No hat, these are the actual measurement outcomes. And a typical measurement outcome can be calculated or measured, but it's not so easy to measure it. But you could calculate it, and this would be a plot of what the measurement outcome would be, where these lines are the level curves. So along these lines, the value of phi is the same. Now, I have to say that, as one of you pointed out last time, this picture was obtained with a so-called ultraviolet cutoff. I didn't allow arbitrarily large k values. Now, that's not just because I didn't want to, but no computer can handle infinitely large k values. If you increase the k values that you allow, more and more k values, so shorter and shorter wavelengths, you will find that this picture becomes more and more complicated. There's more and more structure in there, and the fluctuations actually add up and become larger and larger, and they eventually even get out of hand. But any reasonable measurement instrument, any realistic measurement instrument, will measure the amplitude of the field not at the point, but only over a patch. Because every measurement instrument somehow has a finite size. Even the tip of it that makes the probe will have a finite size. And so arbitrarily large k values, arbitrarily short wavelengths, are in practice never resolved. So whatever picture you get, it corresponds to the picture that you would obtain with a measurement instrument that can measure wavelengths only down to a certain minimum wavelength given by the largest k value that you allow. Okay, so this would be the typical outcome of such a measurement. And then the state of the system after the measurement would be the state phi. And as we just discussed.
Question?
Yep.
Is this a vacuum state?
No, that's not a vacuum state at all. The this is the measurement outcome. It's a typical measurement outcome that you will find if this field started out in the vacuum state. But after you've made that measurement, and let's assume that you've made a von Neumann measurement, an arbitrarily accurate measurement, you've actually measured the amplitude, then afterwards the field is in this state. And that's far from being, it's very far from being the vacuum state. In fact, in some sense, it's the opposite. And namely, let's just think about it a little bit. It's an eigenstate of the phi operator, of all of the phi operators. But the phi hat operators are canonically conjugate to the pi operators. Now, remember that when you are in an eigenstate of x, the uncertainty in p is infinite. Or let's say you're almost in eigenstate of x, so your uncertainty in p is very large, which means that the expectation value of p squared is very large. Here, we are in an eigenstate of phi, or almost in eigenstate of phi, depending on the accuracy of the measurement of the amplitude. So we are almost in eigenstate of phi, which means that the expectation value of the field, canonically conjugate field pi of x, squared in order to get the delta pi that's very large, the expectation value of pi squared has to be very large. But pi squared half is the first term in the Hamiltonian. And that means that in order to measure the field amplitude really accurately, you need a tremendous amount of energy. In fact, to measure it really accurately, with no uncertainty in phi, the expectation value of pi squared, the canonically conjugate field, pi squared of x, would have to be infinite, which means the Hamiltonian would be infinite. It would cost an infinite amount of energy to measure a field really accurately. So on top of the technical difficulties, it's just a matter of budget. It just would be super expensive energetically to measure a field with arbitrary accuracy. Yeah, so that was a very good question. Okay, so that's how, in a sense, this is how a vacuum state looks like, in the sense that if you prepare the field in a vacuum state and then perform a field amplitude measurement, that's typically what you get. But then, of course, it's no longer in a field eigenstate. And then it's no longer in a ground state. Instead, it's a field eigenstate, which means that if, in principle, you measure it immediately again, you would immediately get the same picture again. And just like when you measure the position of something, if you measure it right away again, you find the particle there again. Of course, it really wants to spread the wave function very, very fast. You have to be very quick in measuring it again.
So I guess the vacuum state would be an eigenstate of, say, pi operator?
No, it's an eigenstate of the pi squared plus phi squared operator, right? Yeah, of the Hamiltonian, exactly. It's the lowest energy eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has roughly the form pi squared plus, and then you have, k squared plus m squared times phi squared.
Mm-hmm. But then this outcome is not unique outcome from the measurement, right? You could have, for example, had 10 different vacuum states, and then you would wait them to evolve a little bit, then you would measure them, and not all of them would come out like this, right?
Exactly. If you prepare the field in the vacuum state 100 times, and each time once you've prepared it, you do a measurement of phi everywhere, you get a picture like this, but each time it will look slightly different. It will just look like that one. They will have the same statistics, they will have the same feel to them because they're drawn from the same probability distribution, but each time it's different, yeah. And then if you calculate what the probability distribution is from the measurement, it should match what we predict, right? That's what we calculated last time, the probability distribution. For example, for the Fourier coefficients of these pictures, they have a probability distribution. You can calculate the probability distribution from the measurements, if you can just keep measuring this, or you can calculate it from the quantum field theory. But if, for example, in the computer you simulate this then for the project, well, then you have a probability distribution for the Fourier coefficients of such a picture, and each time you draw from the probability distribution, the computer has to use a random number generator and to pick some Fourier coefficients from those probability distributions, and each time you run it, it will be hopefully a different picture. Maria?
Yeah, so since this picture is different at each time, I was wondering why can't we not have time dependence in the wave in the eigenfunctions, like so that it is like phi of x and t, let's say, in this.
In this?
Yeah. Why would...
Yeah. Well, you see, in this particular case, what would happen is that. We don't measure for a while, so it's just a ground state, and it will be stable in the ground state. And then we measure at time t, we obtain that picture, and then that will describe the state in the sense that if you measure right away again, you get that picture again. But then, if you wait a little bit, then it's just like you've measured the position in ordinary quantum mechanics, it will very quickly flow apart. Because it will be like a very sharp Gaussian, it becomes a very wide Gaussian quickly. And so similarly, if you give this a little bit of time, it will very quickly flow apart, and a repeat measurement will find some very different results. But we cannot, actually we could, but it would be a different situation. We could just continually keep measuring. But if you continually measure the same variable again, then you get a Zeno effect. Right? So you measure an observable, and then even though it may want to evolve, if you measure at a sufficiently quick rate, you tend to freeze the observable. And so in quantum mechanics, if you keep measuring something, then that's a very strong interference with its dynamics.
What did you call it? The Zeno effect?
Zeno.
Zeno, like Zeno the philosopher?
Zeno the Greek, yeah.
Okay.
Right. It's a quantum Zeno effect. Yeah.
So hypothetically, if we spend infinite number of energy to make a precise measurement, so then each measurement of this picture would be the same, right?
If we spend an infinite amount of measurement to measure very accurately the energy, so let's say we start out with the ground state, the vacuum state, and then we invest an arbitrarily large amount of energy, still finite, but arbitrarily large, to measure very accurately what the phi is, we get a picture like this, and then if we measure immediately again, then we get the same picture again. But very quickly, because otherwise it'll flow apart. Because, remember, technically it is because when we're in a phi eigenstate, the expectation value of pi is very large, of pi squared is very large, but pi squared is the speed with which phi is changing. And so it will just rush off, right? In first quantization, if you know the position of a particle very, very well, you don't know its momentum. The momentum could be anything, but that means that a little moment later, it'll have shut off in some direction because of its large momentum uncertainty. All right, so now let's consider the Schrödinger picture. Now, in the Schrödinger, when we speak of quantum mechanics in the Schrödinger picture, we mean two things. They're independent of each other, but usually lumped together when we say Schrödinger quantum mechanics. And these two things are the following. When we say we do Schrödinger quantum mechanics, we mean, first of all, the Schrödinger picture of time evolution. The states evolve in time, and the operators are frozen in time. But when we say we do Schrödinger quantum mechanics, we mean one more thing. We mean that we work in a representation where the position operator is represented by multiplication with x, and in which the momentum operator is represented as minus ih bar d by dx. These two things are independent. You could choose the momentum representation or a Fock representation or whatever in the Schrödinger picture, right? Or you could use a representation of the x and the p one way or the other and then work in the Heisenberg picture. These things are independent of each other, but they are lumped together. And so similarly now, we will do quantum field theory in the Schrödinger way in regards to both of those aspects. So first, we will use a time evolution where the operators are frozen in time and the states are evolving in time. But secondly, the degrees of freedom, which are now no longer x and p, now it's the phis and the pis, those degrees of freedom will be represented in a Schrödinger way. So the phi degrees of freedom will be represented as multiplication with phi. And the pi degree of freedom, the pi hat degree of freedom, right, will be represented as functional differentiation with respect to phi. Just like the x hat operator becomes multiplication with x, the phi hat operator, each one of them for each x, right, for the phi hat operator, each of these phi hat operators becomes multiplication with phi of x as a function, as a number. And the operator pi hat of x, each one of the operators pi hat of x, becomes functional differentiation with respect to phi of x. So all of these two things together give us then the Schrödinger way of doing quantum field theory. You see, it's not actually complicated, it's just a little bit abstract. Okay, so how do we calculate in the Schrödinger picture? As a preparation, let us look at a Hilbert basis. Remember that we had these states. What is such a state? You choose a real valued function over R3, phi, which gives you a particular real number value at each point in space. Could be the measurement outcome, for example, of a measurement of phi hat. And then you write down that state. So this state is eigenstate simultaneously its eigenstate to all of the operators phi hat of x. By the way, we could also alternatively write down an eigenstate which is eigenstate jointly to all of the pi hat of x. But one usually works with those. So this is a joint eigenstate to all of the phi hat of x, and the actual values of that function are the eigenvalues. So such a thing is specified by a function phi of x, so by a number-valued function phi of x. Right? For every number-valued function phi of x over R3, we get one of those states.
Do you impose any regularity conditions on phi of x? I mean, like, is it L squared? Or?
We would love to know what kind of function space that is, but we don't really know. For convenience, let's think of these functions as square integrable, but there's really no reason to think that they should be. Especially differentiability conditions usually just can't be maintained, even though we would like to have that. Now, since these vectors are joint eigenvectors of all the phi hat of x, and the phi hat of x form a maximal set of commuting observables, these guys, in that sense, form a Hilbert basis of the Hilbert space. Just like when you have a joint position eigenvector of all the position operators. Let's say if it's just quantum mechanics of one particle, we have three position operators, and we can write down states which are jointly eigenvectors of all the three position eigenvectors that you would visualize as a delta spike in R3, right? These guys form a position eigenbasis in R3. They form a position eigenbasis in our Hilbert space for particle. Now, in that case, we have only three position operators. That would be all of our degrees of freedom. But here, no. Here we have operators, our degrees of freedom are uncountably many. We have a phi hat of x degree of freedom. For every x, we have another degree of freedom, phi hat. But they commute all of them, and so we say it's a maximal set of commuting observables. I'm skipping over a lot of functional analytic issues here. But philosophically, that's what's going on. So we can use this set as a complete orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. But that means we can also write down a resolution of the identity now. Instead of inserting a resolution of the identity, as we always do in first quantized quantum mechanics in terms of the position eigenbasis, or momentum eigenbasis, or the Fock basis of the harmonic oscillator, I mean, the eigenbasis of the harmonic oscillator or the eigenbasis of the hydrogen atom or whatever. Now, we use the joint eigenbasis of all the phi hat of x. So we can write that this integral here, so the integral over all phi in a function space, which for simplicity we can think of as functions that are square integrable on R3, for each square integrable real-valued function in R3, we have one of those states, and we write down the ket-bra of that, and we integrate over all possible such functions. Then when we apply that to a state psi, we get that state psi again. Right? So this thing alone, this integral alone, is a resolution of the identity. And that here is the measure in this path integral. We are summing here this functional integral. It's called a functional integral. So we are here summing over the space of all functions. So we're not integrating over all real numbers or anything like that. We are integrating over all functions in that function space. Because for every function, for every possible measurement outcome when we measure the field everywhere, for every function, we have a basis vector. Change the function a little bit, another basis vector. Change the function a little bit, another basis vector. All the possible measurement outcomes are orthogonal states. So we have, for every function, another basis vector. We sum them all up in some as yet unspecified way. And then we get a resolution of the identity. In principle, we can apply that onto an arbitrary state of our quantum field theory. we get these wave functions, because these are basis vectors. That's a state. The coefficients of a state in a basis are the wave function, except it's a wave function now, because you're plugging in a whole function here in order to get a number. But more on that a little later. So this is completely analogous to what we do in first quantized quantum mechanics, where we can take position eigenvectors. I'm writing here just Q, but I could put a vector symbol on the Q, because they are typically joint eigenvectors to multiple position operators. And we integrate over all the Q. For example, for one particle, it would be a D3Q. That's the resolution of the identity applied to psi. That's the psi. Very similar. And then this thing here, this abstract state psi, has an overlap with the basis vectors Q, which we then write as psi of Q. Plug in some position eigenvalues, and you get a complex number, which is the probability amplitude for finding the particle at a particular position. In quantum field theory, what do we get? Well, here the overlap is between the abstract state and one of these basis vectors. What kind of basis vector is that again? If the state of the system is one of those phi, then we know what the outcome of a measurement of the amplitude everywhere would be. Right? Remember that if the state of the system is one of those phi, given by a function phi of x, then for sure, if we measure phi hat of x everywhere, for sure the outcome would be that particular function phi of x. So what that means is that this here is a complex number whose modulus square is the probability for finding the state in which the field amplitudes are certainly given by this function phi of x if the quantum field starts out in the state psi. Okay? So if you prepare the quantum field in the state psi, which for example could be the vacuum state or five particle state or whatever, and you want to know, I've prepared the state, the quantum field in the state psi, and I want to know what is the probability that if I measure now the field amplitude phi hat everywhere, what's the probability that the outcome of all these measurements is described by a particular function, let's say a 3D Gaussian? What's the probability that I find that 3D Gaussian? Well, you write down the state that corresponds to that 3D Gaussian. You write down the state phi, which describes a state such that the outcome of the phi hat of x measurements everywhere with certainty will give you the Gaussian. And you calculate that overlap, complex number modulus square is the probability for finding that. So this means that in quantum field theory, we have not seen a method for calculating the probability for finding a particle here or for finding a particle there. This is very difficult, if possible at all, to do such a thing. It's probably impossible to do such a thing, to calculate the probability for finding a particle here or there. I will comment on that a little later again. But what we do have in quantum field theory right away is a method for calculating the probability for finding particular field configuration, for finding particular values for the field at the locations where we measure it. Let's say we measure it everywhere. So we can predict the outcome of, we can predict the probability for finding outcomes of amplitude measurement. So you see, things become the principle stays the same. We're just going from having three observables in quantum mechanics, like Q1, Q2, Q3, three position operators. We go to infinitely many operators phi hat of x. And instead of asking what's the probability for finding the particle at a particular location, x1, x2, x3, or q1, q2, q3, here we can ask what's the probability for finding the field having amplitudes of a particular shape, particular values at particular locations given by phi of x. Oop, what happened there? Okay. Oof. Ay-ay-ay. Oh, it jumped so fast. Okay. All right, so we are arriving at the wave functionale, very similar to the wave function. So let's remember from quantum mechanics, assume that we have a bunch of position operators, q hat over I. It's a complete set of commuting observables with joint eigenvectors q. We could put a vector symbol on this to indicate that this really is a bunch of eigenvalues. You know, a position eigenvector is an eigenvector to multiple position operators, so it has multiple eigenvalues, but we're just writing this as q instead of q1, q2, q3, etc. So this position eigenvector obeys that if you apply any one of the position operators on it, you get some eigenvalue. So then we say that the function obtained by calculating the overlap between the abstract state and the vector q is psi of q, is the wave function. And just in general, just to remind you again, whenever you have an abstract state and you calculate its overlap with a basis, the coefficients are called the wave function. In momentum space, for example, you have a state, you have the momentum eigenvectors, psi of p is the overlap, that's the momentum wave function. And we call it a function because p is continuous. Here we call it a function because q is continuous. But actually, if, for example, we use a discrete basis, such as the eigenbasis of the harmonic oscillator, it's technically not a function of the usual kind, it's a function of a discrete set of numbers, like the n that labels the eigenvectors of the harmonic oscillator, but we may still call it a wave function. Function in the sense that you plug in a number and you get out a number. But in quantum field theory, it's neither of the two cases. It's not that we have just a continuum of values here, or continuum of values there, or discrete set of values like for the harmonic oscillator. But instead, we have an entire function, phi of x. It's really like having the qi, we have the phi hat of x. And instead of having just a few of those I, we have a continuum of them. It's not completely different. It's just instead of having the eigenvalues that depend on a discrete index, we have eigenvalues phi that depend on a continuous index x. So in quantum field theory, we have, and I anticipated all of that in the previous slide, of course, we have that these guys are complete set of commuting observables with joint eigenvectors phi, obeying that operator. The operator at x applied to phi gives us the eigenvalue at x, which would be the measurement outcome for sure, because we are in an eigenstate. And then if psi, and then we can define a wave functionale now for any state psi. So if psi is an abstract state of the quantum field theory, any state whatever, vacuum state, phi eigenstate, seven particle states, whatever, if psi is any state of the quantum field theory, we can calculate the overlap with one of those basis vectors. And that probability amplitude, the collection of those probability amplitudes gives us the wave functionale. And the tradition is that we put here square brackets to indicate that the input is not just one number or a bunch of numbers, but actually it's a collection of numbers phi of x. It's a function that we plug in here. So it's a wave functionale. highly non-linear thing in general. So you choose a function on R3, get that vector from it, which is the state of the field, which has this function as its collection of eigenvalues with respect to the operators phi hat of x. And then this overlap gives you the probability amplitude for finding that state. So that is the wave functional. If we can calculate the wave functional for a quantum field theory, then we have immediately the prediction for the measurement outcome. Right? So this would be the solution to a quantum field theory. Just like in quantum mechanics, if you find the wave function for a Schrödinger problem, psi of x, you're done. Right? Then, because then you can calculate not only what the probability is to find a particle at x, modulus squared, you know, psi of x modulus squared, but you can calculate any prediction if you have the wave function. You just have to put the observable there and then integrate, multiply with psi star psi, integrate it over, right? So you've got the solution. Similarly, in quantum field theory, just a second. Here too, if we can get that wave function out, we're done. We have basically solved the quantum field theory.
So, I mean, for this to happen, I have to have like a whole collection of phis, right? So given a quantum field theory, how do we go about and find those, the family of phis, which will allow me to solve the wave function now?
Okay, so remember the phi are the possible measurement outcomes if you measure the field phi hat. Okay, so remember the field phi hat lives everywhere. At every location x, it's a self-adjoint operator. And if we measure the field at one location, the outcome could be a real number, any real number. Because the spectrum of phi hat is the real line. If we measure the field everywhere at one point in time, we measure the field everywhere. So we measure all those field operators. And the outcome at every location in space will be a real number anywhere on the real line. And in principle, they're independent of each other. So in principle, the outcome could be anything. It could be any function. In practice, we don't think that it makes sense to speak of literal points. There is probably a limitation to how accurately things can be resolved. Not just in practical terms, a measurement of phi will not measure phi at a point, but every measurement instrument has a finite extent, so it measures the average value of phi in the region. But also fundamentally, we think there's a limit. But in principle, as far as the mathematical description goes that we have now, yeah, the phi could be measured everywhere, and independently any value could come out. So in principle, our phi here are arbitrary.
It's a Q, which could be anything on the real line, right?
Yes, exactly. In quantum mechanics, we have Q1, Q2, Q3. And there is no constraint on these three relative. I mean, one could be larger, a little smaller, etc. And so similarly with the phi. In practice, we expect that it is unlikely. Okay. So yes, in principle, you can measure the phi at every location, and there could be independently a different amplitude found in the measure. But then we can ask, what's the probability that we will find huge values of phi? What's the probability that we will find that all those phi values are like a gazillion everywhere? In principle, it's an observable that has a real line as its spectrum. Anything's possible. But there is a Hamiltonian. And that Hamiltonian has a term in it, m squared times phi squared, which means large field amplitudes, phi, are energetically expensive. That's why it's unlikely to find the field phi of very large values or very large negative values, because phi squared times m is in the Hamiltonian, it's energetically expensive. The wave functional reflects that. If we actually calculate what that is, the wave functional, we will find that if we plug in a field phi, which is everywhere very large, we find that its overlap, no matter what the state is going to be low, because it's energetically very expensive. Also, we can ask, what's the probability that we find, when we measure the field phi everywhere, what's the probability that we find that the field has a certain value here, and then at the neighboring location, it has a very, very different amplitude? That, again, is quite unlikely. And the reason is that it means there's a huge gradient. The derivative of the field would be large. But the spatial derivative of the field, in fact, the second spatial derivative, the Laplacian, is in the Hamiltonian. Therefore, big changes in the field are also energetically penalized. Right? So therefore, it is quite unlikely to find the field to be very spiky and rough. At least that's what the intuition tells us, right? It should be quite unlikely to find that because the Hamiltonian suppresses it, makes it energetically expensive to have large derivatives there. So in principle, we should expect that the field wants to be close to zero amplitude and close to constant. But of course, there are kind of fluctuations. It fluctuates about everything, but that's basically what he wants to do. Be quiet, not much action, right? Just a low amplitude, close to zero, and relatively constant. Everything else costs energy, and therefore is energetically suppressed. All right, so but how do we calculate such a wave function? Well, that's the interpretation of the wave function that I already mentioned. Just very quickly, so that we don't dismiss this, the slide. Assume that the system is an arbitrary state psi. Then if we now measure the phi hat of x everywhere in space at the same time, then what's the probability that the outcome of these measurements will be a function phi of x? Well, the phi of x corresponds to a state, phi overlap with psi modulus squared. That's the probability. Technically, actually, it's a probability density. Right? Remember, even in ordinary first quantized quantum mechanics, we don't really get position probabilities. We get probability densities. The wave function psi of x modulus squared doesn't give us the probability for finding the particle at x. No, the probability for finding the particle at x is zero. No, you get a probability density. You have to integrate it a little bit over a little interval, and then you get a finite probability for finding it in that interval. And so similarly here, in principle, you need to do a little bit of a functional integration around a neighborhood of field configurations to get a finite probability to finding a particular field configuration. The probability for finding an exact field configuration is zero, just the same way that the probability for finding an exact position for an electron is also zero. You only get probability densities. Yeah?
So in the first quantization, for the probability density, we can integrate over all the positions to normalize to one, right?
Mm.
Like in this case, in second quantization, how do we find normalization? Because we cannot integrate over all phi, right?
Formally, we did it because we have a resolution of the identity. So similarly, you would have that, you know, you have a functional integration for the resolution of the identity,
right,
and that gives you the normalization. You know, just take psi psi. If psi is the state of the field, psi psi,
okay,
you say the psi psi is one, and then you put the resolution of the identity in here, which is the functional integral over the phi. Right? So, so we have 1 equal to psi phi. This is an arbitrary state of the quantum field. And then we say that this is equal to psi identity psi. And we write the identity now in this way. The integral over phi by d phi. And then formally you put this integral out there, perhaps on that over here. But nobody has succeeded of making this mathematically accurate. Not in this way of writing things. If we put the system into a big box so that only a discrete set of momenta occur, and we cut off the highest momentum that we still allow, then we have only a finite number of degrees of freedom, and that makes sense. You can actually do these things. And this becomes a finite number of integrations then. And so then it makes sense. But in principle, the way we write it here, we have uncountably many integrations in here. So why don't we do it the proper way so that it makes analytic sense? The reason is that it would be tedious, right? If always we work with a box and an ultraviolet cutoff, a cutoff on the largest momentum, then we have to drag this along all the time. And there's a lot of arbitrariness in that. The box breaks is irrelevant fundamentally because you can make it so big that it's larger than our horizon in the universe. It's irrelevant, but it breaks Lorentz symmetry. It would be just tedious to drag them along. So in all those calculations, in this formalism and what we do here, it's always a caveat that it becomes well-defined if you impose an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, and the extra caveat that there may be subtleties when you try to remove those cutoffs. So, remember I said that when we talk of Schrödinger quantum mechanics, we mean two things. Time evolution is the Schrödinger picture, so the states evolve in time and the operators are frozen. And secondly, we say that we represent the position operators on multiplication with position, on position wave functions psi of x, and we represent the momentum operator as minus ih bar differentiation with respect to position acting on position wave function psi of x. We want to do the same thing here. And what we've just discussed is the second part. What we've just discussed is that that we have wave functions, right? So psi of x. The analog of psi of x is psi of phi, the wave functional. We've just done that. What we will now have to do to complete the Schrödinger version of quantum field theory is the time evolution, what's the Schrödinger equation, and what is the representation of phi and pi on the wave functionals, psi of phi. And I already mentioned it, let me just anticipate it again. Phi hat will be represented as multiplication with phi, acting on the wave function L. And the operators pi hat of x will be represented as functional differentiation with respect to phi minus I h bar d by d phi of x, acting on the wave function L psi of phi. Okay. So what is the equation of motion for our wave function L? Remember, that's the probability amplitude for finding the field configuration phi. By field configuration, I mean the outcome of a field measurement everywhere at one point in time. Right? So a real valued function phi of x, that's the field configuration. So psi hat of phi is the probability amplitude density for finding a particular field configuration at the point t in time. That's the wave function now. It depends, of course, on the state psi that the quantum field is in. Every state psi has a wave functional psi of phi. And similarly, we could also define a psi of pi and psi of other bases too. We don't have to use the joint eigenbases of all the phi as we do here. We could use the joint eigenbases of all the pi and Fock eigenbases as well, and so on. But that's that's what we need to do to get the Schrödinger picture. Okay, so the time evolution for the wave functional is a Schrödinger equation, the quantum field theoretical Schrödinger equation. Now, for every quantum theory, be it first quantized or second quantized, for every quantum theory, we have that in the Schrödinger picture, the time evolution is this one. IH bar d by dt of the state as a function of time is equal to the Hamiltonian applied to the state as a function of time. And we already calculated the Hamiltonian for the Klein-Gordon theory. So this is the abstract equation without choosing a representation. Here we've chosen a representation, I mean the analog of the position representation, but here's the phi representation, the eigenbasis of the phi hat observables. So now let's use this basis and let's write down the Schrödinger equation, the abstract Schrödinger equation, where no basis has been chosen, these are just the abstract vectors, and let's write it as a Schrödinger equation of the usual form. So here in quantum field theory, what is the Hamiltonian? If you remember, the Hamiltonian is this. It is the integral over 1 half and then pi hat squared plus phi hat of x minus the Laplacian plus m squared phi integral d3x. We also wrote it down in the momentum representation where it's very similar, but we have pi hat dagger of k and a pi, and here we had phi hat dagger of k, and here phi k, and this became a k squared. One big difference to the Hamiltonian that we had before is that because we are now working in the Schrödinger picture of time evolution, this Hamiltonian is now frozen in time. These operators are no longer time dependent. Previously they were, iceberg picture, now they're frozen in time, and so is our Hamiltonian. It's the states that are now time dependent. But then how shall we let the phi hat and the pi hat act on wave functionals? So in quantum mechanics, first quantized quantum mechanics, we have the position and the momentum operators. And they're just abstract operators that obey some commutation relation. But then when we choose a particular representation, they take particular form. Like the position operator becomes multiplication operator, and the momentum operator minus I times the derivative operator in the position representation. Here we have this pair, these pairs of canonically conjugate observables, phi hat of x and pi hat of x. Oh, and look, no t. Why? Schrödinger picture. Right? Schrödinger picture. So there's just one phi hat of x observable for every x, one pi hat of x observable for every x, and they have these commutation relations. Now it turns out that in analogy to quantum mechanics, where we have that the position operators can act on position wave functions, which now depend on time, as multiplication with the eigenvalue, with the position times the wave function, we have here too. Here, the phi hat are the degrees of freedom, the amplitudes are the degrees of freedom, and these can be applied to a wave functional indicated by this dot. That's often the notation to say that we have an abstract operator, like here position operator, acting on a wave function. You see, we have to use a dot here because otherwise the notation would really be inconsistent. Because this is an abstract operator in a Hilbert space. Why would it act on a wave function? It cannot. It can only act on a vector in a Hilbert space, right? Operator and vector, that's how it works. But that's not a vector in a Hilbert space, that's a collection of coefficients. It's a wave function. It's the overlap between a vector psi and basis vectors q. This is just a collection of overlaps, which happens to be a function. And so the dot indicates that what we're dealing with here is a representation of the abstract operator. So we have this abstract operator on a Hilbert space, which acts on the picture of this abstract operator in the basis, the position basis, in this way. Okay, so if you take the abstract operator and apply it to the abstract vector psi, then the position representation of that is this. This is what this really says, logically, if you really want to get to the bottom of it. And similarly here, in quantum mechanics, the abstract momentum operator acts on the abstract state psi. Now the abstract state psi can be represented in the position representation, and then it becomes psi of q and t. It's the overlaps, right? But you can also apply your momentum operator on the abstract vector psi, and then look at the position representation of it, and what you get is minus I times the derivative of it. And that's what this notation means, the dot. It means representation of. So similarly here, the phi hat is really acting on the abstract Hilbert space of states of the quantum field theory, but every state can be represented as a wave function L. And therefore, the action of every operator on the state has an action on the representation, and that's the action on the representation. So when we apply phi hat of x onto a wave function L, we get just phi of x times the wave function L. And when we apply the operator pi hat of x onto the wave function L, we get minus I functional derivative of the wave function L. I invite you to check whether that's consistent. What do you have to do? You have to check whether the commutation relations hold. So you can apply phi hat of x, pi hat of x, and then afterwards phi hat of x minus the other way around applied to a wave function L, and check whether that is the same as if you applied IH bar d by dx, IH bar, and then Dirac delta of x onto the wave function L. So this is a functional derivative in the same way that you know functional derivatives from the derivation of the Euler-Lagrange equations from an action. Same thing. Right? So you functional differentiate with respect to a function. By the way, this is not fundamentally something new. Functional derivatives can be expressed in terms of ordinary derivatives. Just choose a different basis in your function space. If you choose a continuous basis, such as the position or momentum basis, you would say, oh, I have a functional derivative. But then in the same function space, you could choose a discrete basis, such as a basis of Hermite functions, like the eigenfunctions of the harmonic oscillator. Now we have a discrete set of them. And then the same business, the same functional differentiation becomes a bunch of ordinary differentiation. So it's not fundamentally different. Okay, so what we have is that the abstract operators, field operators, phi hat and pi hat, can be represented as multiplication and functional differentiations acting on wave function L. And that means that our Hamiltonian, let's see if I can put everything on one in one view. Here's the Hamiltonian. In our Hamiltonian, the pi squared will be represented when this Hamiltonian acts on a wave function L, the pi squared will be second functional derivative with respect to phi. And the phi will be multiplication, phi hat will be multiplication by phi. So what we find is that the Hamiltonian of quantum field theory, when acting on a wave function L, is given by the usual formulation, except that pi squared became this with a minus, because we have here the minus I. When you square that, you get the minus goes away, but the I squared becomes a minus. That's why there's a minus. And we have the phi of x minus Laplacian plus m squared phi of x. So in practice, how does this machinery work? It means something very concrete. You can write down here the wave function L, psi of phi. What is this, the psi of phi? What does a function L do? You plug in a function phi of x, and you get out a number. Right? That this was psi of x does. And the Hamiltonian acts on that by doing this. You take the wave function L, which is where you plug in phi, get out a number, and then you multiply what you get out with phi of x. And then you differentiate what you get with respect to x according to the Laplacian, multiply with m squared and multiply phi, and then we take what the outcome of the functional was and you functionally differentiate you with respect to phi twice, etc. It's all very concrete and can be actually done. If you write down, for example, a wave functional as a power series in phi, right, which you can do, then you see what it does. It will add extra powers to the phi, some derivatives to the phi, and then it will differentiate the power series in phi to get lower powers of phi. So this can all be made completely explicit. Okay, so now, in practice though, it's often useful, as I said, to work with infrared cutoffs and ultraviolet cutoffs to reduce the number of degrees of freedom, to make them a discrete set of degrees of freedom, and also to reduce the number, let's say, to a finite number. Okay, let's say we want to work with in a box, so we use infrared regularized momentum space. In this case, we have that our canonical commutation relations are these. This is obtained by Fourier transformation. And then since we put everything into a box, the k values are discrete, the discrete grid. So now our wave functionals are psi of phi tilde. These are already a little bit better behaved than the psi of the phi that we had before. Because the phi tilde are the Fourier transformed versions of the phi. The same field can be input into the functional either directly or in its Fourier transformed form. That doesn't change what the field is. But the Fourier transformed version of the field is nicer because working in a box, it's given by a discrete set of coefficients, the Fourier coefficient, the Fourier series coefficient. So therefore, the wave functional now depends on, it has as input a bunch of Fourier series coefficients. You can describe the field phi by its Fourier coefficients. You plug them in here and you get a probability amplitude density for finding those Fourier coefficients. And if you also put an ultraviolet cutoff, so if you say, well, no momento larger than this, because I can't resolve any distances smaller than that, then you only have a finite number of Fourier coefficients. For example, in the project, only a finite number of Fourier coefficients, of course, because the computer cannot handle more. So then it actually becomes more like a wave function, because the probability amplitude density will take as input a finite number of Fourier coefficients. You describe the possible field configuration by a finite number of Fourier coefficients, you plug them in there, you get a probability amplitude. So how does that work now? What's the representation of the Fourier transformed field and the Fourier transformed conjugate field on the wave functional expressed in terms of the Fourier coefficient? Well, I'm claiming that it works like this. The phi hat k acting on this wave functional given by multiplication with the Fourier coefficient, and the pi hat of k is working by minus I d by d phi minus k, the Fourier coefficient. And again, you can easily verify that the canonical commutation relations are respected, and therefore that this is a valid representation. Just check what happens if you first apply the pi and then the phi and minus the other way around, you should get the Kronecker delta. And you see, it's no longer a functional derivative, it's just an ordinary derivative, because we have just a discrete set of them. Yeah, it all happens in the box. Right. Okay, and in the box, if the box has side lengths, L, then the allowed values of K, of the K vector, are given by this. The K vector has three integers here, positive or negative or zero integers here, multiplied with 2 pi over L. If you make the size of the box go to infinity, L grows to infinity, which means this prefactor becomes very, very small, which means that these values that the k can take become very, very dense. Eventually, you recover the continuum again. Okay, so now we have the Schrödinger equation in the momentum representation. So I h bar times the time derivative of the wave functional, which takes as input the Fourier series coefficients of our function, given by this Hamiltonian acting on the wave functional, where we have again second derivatives, but now they are with respect to the Fourier coefficients of the field and here multiplication. And you just have to do these things carefully to see that there's a k here and a minus k there, k here, minus k there. Now, let's remember that for quantum mechanics, the first quantized harmonic oscillator, the ground state Schrödinger wave function is this. The wave function in the, as far as the position is concerned, the ground state of a harmonic oscillator is given by this Gaussian. The higher the frequency, the narrower the Gaussian. And this is just the normalization factor to make the norm of the wave function 1. And the time evolution of the ground state is simply, well, it's, you know, constant in time except for a phase, because it's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. So the time dependence is simply given by e to the power minus I omega t. so that's the time evolution of the harmonic oscillator. Actually, I think there should be a 1/2 here, because that's the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator. And so similarly, the ground state solution in quantum field theory, given that in quantum field theory, in for the Klein-Gordon theory in Minkowski space, without a potential or curvature, we just have a bunch of harmonic oscillators, except for the subtlety with a k and a minus k. Right? So if you want to calculate this yourself, be careful with this. We can check that this Schrödinger equation is actually solved by that wave functional. Again, I'm not too sure, there might be a factor of 1/2 here. So the claim is that this is the Schrödinger equation that we have to solve. And it's plausible that this is the solution, given that that's the solution for the usual harmonic oscillator. See, if this was not k and minus k, but just k and k, then that would be the Schrödinger equation for a bunch of ordinary harmonic oscillators. Right? It's just the second derivative, and then a coefficient times the x squared. Right? So this is like d by dx squared, and then this is x squared. It's just the usual harmonic oscillator. Schrödinger picture would be the usual harmonic oscillator for harmonic oscillator wave function, and lots of them, because for every k, we get another harmonic oscillator. So apart from that subtlety here, we should expect that the solution to this would be similar. And in fact, the solution is this one. And in fact, it's not difficult to just check that. Just plug that into here and see if it solves it or not. If you do, you will solve a quantum field theory in the Schrödinger formulation. Okay, so what is it? The wave functional for the Klein-Gordon theory in Minkowski space in a box is this. So this gives us the probability amplitude density for finding any field configuration we want. Choose the field configuration so that the field takes such and such values and such locations, a function phi of x. So we choose the function phi of x and we ask, what's the probability that the field configuration comes out to be this if we measure it, assuming that the field is in the vacuum state. Because this was the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, and that's going to be the ground state solution for the quantum field. This is not the unique solution for that Schrödinger equation. Just like the Schrödinger equation for the harmonic oscillator has many solutions, right? All of the eigenstates and all of the linear combinations of them similarly here in quantum field theory. But just like this is the ground state solution of the harmonic oscillator in first quantization, that is the ground state solution of the quantum field in the momentum representation. So what I wanted to say is that assuming that the quantum field is prepared in the vacuum state, we can ask what's the probability that we will find particular measurement outcomes at particular locations, a function phi of x. And then we Fourier transform that function phi of x. And we get its Fourier series coefficient. Because it's all in a box, we get a discrete set of coefficients phi k for discrete values of k. If you put an ultraviolet cutoff, it's just a finite number of coefficients k. And these coefficients, phi k or phi tilde k, these coefficients you plug in here. Phi k and phi minus k, multiply them. Multiply with the omega k. Remember what omega k is? It's just the square root of k squared plus n squared. And minus I omega kt, that factor doesn't actually impact the probability for finding any field configuration because it's just a phase. Right? It's e to the power I times something. It's just a phase. It drops out in the calculation of the modulus square of that. And it should, because it's a ground state. It's an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, so the probability shouldn't change over time. Okay, so you put those Fourier coefficients in here, and then you get a number there, and the modulus square of that is the probability amplitude density, is the probability density for finding that particular field configuration. And what do we see? We see that if, for example, you ask, what's the probability for finding very large Fourier coefficients? So what's the probability of finding a field that has very large amplitudes? Well, the probability for finding a field with very large amplitude means we're looking for the probability for a field, finding a field which has very large Fourier coefficients as well. But if the Fourier coefficients are large, well, then we have e to the power of minus something large. That's suppressed, very heavily suppressed, stronger than exponentially. It's a Gaussian. So what we see here again is that the, the smaller the amplitudes are that we are looking for, the more likely we are to find them. And especially for high frequencies, we find that if omega is very large, so if we look at very short wavelengths, for very short wavelengths, this is a large number to start with, which already means e to the power minus a large number, probably very small. And then we multiply that too. So the higher the frequency, the larger the k value is, the shorter the wavelength is, the more unlikely it becomes to find a large amplitude. Now, I should point out at this point here that one might take away from this that quantum fluctuations are most likely to happen for small values of k, for large wavelengths. And quantum fluctuations are more like are less likely to happen for small wavelengths, for large k values. Just because for large k values, we have a Gaussian suppression here of the amplitudes. No, actually not Gaussian, but exponential, because this is proportional to k here. That is in principle true if our quantum field theory was living in one dimension. But as we will later see, the higher the dimension of space is, the less is true what I just said. In principle, the logic applies, as I said, but we have to keep in mind that there are a lot of large k values. If you take a box, for example, there will be a small number of small k values, but then, you know, there's a lot of large k values. And so actually, it will so happen that that will make more than up for it. So that each individual short wavelength mode is unlikely to be significantly excited, but because there are so many of them, from a certain number of dimensions onwards, which happens to be 3, it takes over. And we have a lot of fluctuations at short wavelength. So in our actual universe, quantum fluctuations are more likely to be large at small wavelengths than they are at long wavelengths. Electromagnetic field, we don't see fluctuating at wavelengths of 5 meters very much. But we see it fluctuating very clearly at very tiny, very small wavelengths, like at a nanometer scale, where it is responsible for the Casimir effect, for example. Again, that's something that you may want to explore in the project. Just try things out. See how typical quantum fluctuations look like for a quantum field that lives in 1 dimensions, 2 dimensions, 3 dimensions, 4, 5 dimensions. And let's say, leave out the 1-dimensional case. Let's just say 2, 3, 4, 5 dimensions, and then always plot a slice through 2 dimensions. And I think I mentioned it last time already that you will see that the quantum fluctuations become more and more pronounced as the dimension goes up, even when you look at 2-dimensional slices every time. Okay, so this was the wave functional of the ground state, but there are, can look at a generic wave functional. So assume that the system is in a state alpha other than the ground state. So some mode oscillators are not in the ground state, but if an oscillator is excited, then its wave function will spread out. And what that means is, and I think I have a little plot for this, so remember that what we saw 2 slides up is that the way we solve the ordinary harmonic oscillator in the Schrödinger picture can help us to solve the many harmonic oscillators of the quantum field in the Schrödinger picture. And so in particular, I showed you the solution for the ground state of the ordinary harmonic oscillator, and that translated immediately into a solution for the ground state of the quantum field. You just have lots of them. And then there was this K minus K business. But then let's look at ordinary quantum mechanics, first quantized harmonic oscillator, and an excited state. In an excited state, the wave function of the harmonic oscillator looks like this. You know why? Imagine you have a big pendulum. Harmonic oscillator, right? Then classically, where is it most likely to be found? At the ends, you see, here and there, because it's slow there. Whereas it rushes through the origin. It's more rarely to be found at the origin, more likely to be found out there in the long elongations. And that's exactly also how it is for highly excited harmonic oscillators. The wave function gets these 2 bumps. Of course, classically, it could not be found further out than a certain distance, but quantum mechanically, this decays in some way. So in any case, the higher the excitation of the harmonic oscillator is, the more it takes this kind of form, which means that this probability distribution, unlike that one, which gives you most likely small amplitudes of phi, of the Fourier coefficients phi, I'm talking about the application to the fields now, where this is the distribution of Fourier coefficients. Now, for excited harmonic oscillators, let's say for one of the modes, the harmonic oscillator is highly excited, this is the probability distribution. Now we see that large amplitudes for the Fourier coefficients are more likely than small amplitudes. And that means that if you then plot level curves or something like that, you should find that the Fourier coefficients of those modes that are in the ground state are distributed typically like this, small coefficients, so just a bit of noise everywhere. But the Fourier coefficient of the mode that you chose to be excited, this Fourier coefficient tends to be large. And that means that when you plot things, you get one Fourier coefficient that produces a large sine wave, for example, in your picture. But you also get the other Fourier coefficients that give you some general noise everywhere. And so you can see then what difference one particle makes. If you choose one particular mode oscillator to be the first excited state, you're slightly increasing the chances that its amplitude are a little bit elevated, right? And so you see then what difference it makes if you have one particle in a box as far as the field is concerned. You can see how it looks like. One particle in a box with particular momentum. Do you get a clean plane wave plus the usual quantum fluctuations on top of that? Or are the quantum fluctuations dominant over the plane wave? How many particles do you need to put into the same mode so that the plane wave that they correspond to rises significantly above the general noise? Or also, you don't have to create particles by just exciting one mode. You could create a wave packet by exciting a bunch of modes such that the Fourier transform gives you a packet. And in this way, you can localize a particle in your box instead of just having a standing wave in there. Anyway, things to explore. And let me just tell you that if you worry about this k minus k business, in the description of the project, I'm explaining how if you put Dirichlet boundary conditions instead of periodic boundary conditions on the box, then you avoid the problem with the k and minus k altogether. It just doesn't come up. All your harmonic oscillators are very clean, all self-adjoined. You never have anything to do with complex amplitudes there. Much simpler. All right, so I'm referring you here to the project description, and have a look at that. We're done for today. I think I will clean up the project description a little bit. I want to make it a little bit nicer and perhaps give a little bit more details. But also give me feedback if something is unclear. I'm happy to improve on that. Deepa? So,
the phi k and phi minus k, are they kind of related to the eigenvalues of what in, say, another description I would call a k and a dagger k, like the creation and annihilation?
Yes, we will later express the phi k as the sum of a and ak, and the pi as I times the difference of the two. Yes. So far we haven't needed that, but of course much of the course will use exactly that decomposition. But I find that if we start with the a and a daggers too early, then you might get the impression that they are somehow fundamental.
Right.
But they're not, they're a tool. They're just a tool. Okay, we're done for today.